This podcast is sponsored by Smartsheet, the cloud-based work management platform and best-kept secret of more than half the Fortune 500 companies.
How the app get made, explain your trade, what you love to do every day, the ins and outs of what your code's about, or the passion you know you can't live without. How's your data stored or sorted, transformed or imported? Let's chat a bit at a conference, and if it's cool, may re-record it. What framework do you like the best? Explain to us your unit test. Do you have a tip for JavaScript or a dev kit that we can tinker with? A process, a methodology, in depth, no apologies. Step up your code, stay on your toes, cross-cutting concerns with Matt Groves.
You're listening to the Cross-Cutting Concerns podcast. I'm your host, Matt Groves. Please visit the site at crosscuttingconcerns.com, where you can subscribe, browse the archives, contact me, read show notes, and leave a comment.
On your toes, Cross-Cutting Concern with Matt Groves.
This is Wager Vets Moth, aka Matthew Groves. My voice is my passport. Verify me. I'm recording this podcast on January 18th, 2018. My guest today is difficult to describe in one sentence. He helps people write more secure software and is a true one-of-a-kind. Elf Blimps, a.k.a. Bill Semph, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me on, Wager.
No problem. So before we start talking about this movie, Mr. Elf, could you talk about the kind of stuff you do and the interesting hobbies you have? I think it will help the listeners understand why I wanted to discuss this particular movie, Sneakers, with you.
Sure. So I am an application vulnerability analyst. After 20 years of being in enterprise development space and being kind of the security guy on the dev team all that time, I rolled into spending the majority of my time either testing applications for security vulnerabilities or fixing those vulnerabilities. As such, I kind of have one foot in the developer community and one foot in the security community. So as part of the security community, I get into weird things sometimes, like signals intelligence and lock picking and strange, odd hobbies that map pretty closely to a lot of the people on the sneak team in the movie. So I understand the balance point you were shooting for there.
Absolutely. And also, you are something of a trained ninja as well.
I am something of one, though. I am a little out of practice, but that is indeed true. I studied a martial art where things like stealth entering and lying are part of the belt curriculum, which is not normally something you do in the dojo, but it is for us.
Yeah. So if anyone's a real-life sneaker, I think Bill Semph is definitely on that team. So let's talk about this film, Sneakers. It was released in 1992. This is a film, one of my favorite films, maybe my top 10 films. And I want to talk about it a little bit as a movie first, and then we'll get into some of the interesting themes why I had you on the show. So I know you're not really a movie buff. You're not into actors and all the interesting trivia and stuff like that. But I think we have to start with the cast talking about this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just you watch it, and it didn't make a huge splash when it came out. I don't know. Would you consider it almost a cult classic? I don't know if it falls in the same category as some of those, but you look at the lead cast and it's a who's who.
Absolutely. I mean, really, starting with Robert Redford, obviously.
Yeah.
Sidney Poitier, one of the greatest actors in history of the world. And then Ben Kingsley is in it as well.
Yeah.
Which is, he's not even top billed. That gives you the idea of what this movie is like.
And it gets me at the, well, spoilers, sorry, but at the end when, you know, who else do they have to make the deal with but Darth Vader?
I want peace on Earth and goodwill toward men.
Oh, this is ridiculous. Are you serious?
I want peace on Earth and goodwill toward men.
We are the United States government. We don't do that sort of thing.
You know?
Oh, yeah, James Earl Jones. Yeah.
I mean, for crying out loud.
Dan Aykroyd is in this movie,
mm-hmm.
Which works, I think.
Absolutely.
This is post-Ghostbusters, but it still works. Yep.
As a conspiracy theorist, too, it was the best.
Yes,
yeah. Cow mutilations.
And then there's a whole list of character actors in here. River Phoenix, I don't know if you consider him a character actor, but the late River Phoenix is in here.
Yeah. It was only a year before
he died, too. Yeah. So a lot of other character actors, Mary McDonnell is sort of the love interest here. Mm-hmm. She was, of course, in Battlestar Galactica, for all you nerds out there, like me. Stephen Tobolowsky plays an important role, but also a comedic role. Yep. You probably don't know the name, but you probably know him from Groundhog Day, Memento, and a million other roles. One of them, actor that stood out to me recently, just watching it this time around, is Donald Logue. And he plays the professor, Gunter Janik.
Oh, wow, okay.
And he is an incredible character actor, and he's hard to spot because he's always different in every role. A different voice, a different attitude. I mean, he's an incredible character actor. So I spotted him in this movie this time around. I didn't really notice him before.
Neat.
So, yeah, amazing cast in this movie. I could go on and on about that the whole time. But another thing that stood out about this movie, and in general, to me, important thing for movies is the music.
Yeah.
This has a very sort of unique soundtrack. What did you think of the... You have some music background. What did you think of the soundtrack?
I do. So I was introduced to the composer of the core soundtrack by researching for this podcast. But what gets me is the kind of smooth, you know, jazzy, kind of almost like elevator music type. I mean, really, it's not the kind of stuff you'd expect to have in a movie that has quite a bit of action in it. But it so fits the rhetoric, especially for Redford in his role, you know, a player, somebody who in today in the social, in the security world, we'd say social engineer. His theme really fits with him, a little sleazy, but still really has a solid base to it. I don't know. I think he did a really fantastic job. And the use of music, and more importantly, even the non-use of music, when they dropped the soundtrack and just went with just what the actors were, how the actors were interacting, was, I don't know, I loved it. And I hadn't really, I mean, I guess I noticed it before. This viewing, it was much more front and center for me.
And we'll probably splice in some of my favorite cuts of the music in this episode.
But yeah, a little bit of background noise.
The creator of the music for this movie is the great James Horner. Mm-hmm. Who I didn't realize it was him. I didn't realize what an incredible catalog of soundtracks he's done.
Yeah, it was totally new to me too. I hadn't connected all these movies as the, you know, from Aliens to Braveheart and Avatar to Field of Dreams. I mean, that's a broad spectrum of movies, and I'm gonna have to go back and do some listening.
Yeah, absolutely. Field of Dreams also had James Earl Jones in it.
It did, yeah.
A little connection there. So yeah, I think the music definitely works, and it is a little, it's not what you expect from your typical like hacker movie. You know, it's not techno, no. It's not hard rock or anything like that.
That's right.
It's like easy listening music.
There, of course, is technical stuff in the movie, but largely the movie is about the social side of things, figuring out, doing the research, doing the operational security. Sidney Poitier's role is as an ex-CIA agent. He kind of drives this hardcore operational security theme, you know, locking down the room and when they get caught and stuff like that, making sure that everybody's got their ducks in a row, as it were. But Redford's role and his social engineering side of things, that's what really drives the soundtracks. It's all very smooth, very handling situations very well, always having the right line at the right time. There's the one particular scene where he gets caught digging through the professor's office by the professor's mistress, and he's got a, you know, an earpiece in, and the truck's trying to feed him lines, and they're like, something happened. Like, we got nothing, and he just comes up with the perfect line on the spot. And even the people in the truck are going, "Okay, that was good." So keep an eye out for that scene. That's one of those scenes where they drop the soundtrack.
Yes,
and it's just the actors doing what the actors do, and it was that. But that vibe fits so well with the kind of smooth, laid back. It's not, you know, Matrix all, you know, gunning and running 24/7. It's the way security really is for the people doing the testing. A lot of background research, a lot of taking notes, a lot of looking at papers, a lot of figuring things out about people, and then, you know, a few minutes of, okay, let's implement this.
Yeah, definitely. We're going to talk about social engineering a lot today, and definitely it's sort of the con man vibe that Martin Bishop has there.
Yeah,
I want to spend a second talking about the age of this movie. It was released in 92, September 11th, 1992. So it's 26 years old, and I still enjoy watching this movie. Did you watch it when it first came out? Do you remember?
No, not when it first came out, but it was soon thereafter. I think it was about 5 years after we did a hacker movie early. This is like 97, okay? So this is going back ways. We did a Hacker Movie Fest at one point and had this in War Games and a couple of other older, you know, Lawnmower Man kind of weird stuff like that. So I think that was the first time I saw it. But now it's in my library, and I've watched it several times when I just get in the mood to watch hacker movies. I like the fact that really the technology, with the exception of the thickness of the monitors, because they're all CRTs in the movie, right? Big right. Heavy, fat monitors. And today we'd all be using LCD screens. But aside from that, there's no weird visualizations or strange graphics or odd stuff. It's all like the electronics largely hold up. Even the phone system stuff they do largely is the same as it is today. Not 100%, but you can envision an attack that would still take place by, you know, going down in the manhole and, you know, finding the box and changing around the phone cables and putting in hooks and running them up to the truck. And it's that a lot of that same stuff happens today. I mean, we do more signal stuff now because wireless is so much more prevalent, but there's still lots and lots and lots of landlines, and it still makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I'm looking at the sets and the equipment in this movie just to try to pick it apart a little bit. It's not aspirational in the technology. It's very, like, this is grungy old equipment that they just, you know, this is what they could afford. There's a Gold Star monitor. You know, there's not a sleek MacBook in the frame. It's just a cheap old grungy monitor.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
The sets aren't super glamorous, like the Playtronics building towards the end of the movie. It's just an office building. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not this crazy room or, you know, crazy building with all kinds of ridiculous architecture.
Yeah, they really tried to set it as if it was actually happening, not some fantasy world. And there's a place for that too. I mean, there's it's a different kind of movie. This movie was set up like I don't even know what you'd call it, but a regular crime flick sort of, you know?
A heist movie.
That's exactly, yeah. Ocean's 11 kind of thing. I mean, they didn't dress that up. That's really how casinos look inside. They filmed a lot of that inside the casinos. That's very much how this was done. And so all the people in the three-letter agencies for the government, their offices looked about like they were, even the fake ones. Yeah. they looked like what those offices look like in real life. It was very cool. And they still look that way largely.
you mentioned the computers. There's not a lot of fancy graphics going on here. I think really it's all about the story that drives this movie. And I think there are some things that are a bit far-fetched. Maybe we'll talk about those. But I think with a few, even just really minor tweaks, this movie could easily be set in 2018 and still be compelling.
Yeah, the decrypting something is boring to look at.
Yeah.
I mean, in real life, they fantasize that a little bit.
Yes.
But that, it might be the only thing.
I think you might be right on that. There's a few other nitpicks that I have. We'll talk about those later.
Yeah, we'll get those. Yeah, sure.
This movie had a budget of $35 million. I'm going to guess that's mostly for the incredible cast.
Like I said,
the sets are not crazy. The stunts aren't overwhelmingly expensive.
All right.
This movie made box office $105 million. So this was a profitable movie. Probably more like a cult classic, like you're saying. It's not making huge bank, but pretty impressive.
Absolutely.
All right, so I want to talk about some of the themes in this movie next. And one of the main themes, of course, is cryptography. And as Liz says during the lecture, she says they're unbreakable codes.
Right.
What are your thoughts on the cryptography as presented in this movie and codes being unbreakable?
Let me start by saying, of all the security topics, encryption is probably my weakest. I'm not a mathematician. I get the large sweeping things that we have to deal with in application security, but the very deep intricacies of encryption I'll leave to people a lot smarter than me. That said, there are absolutely ways to create encoded communications that literally cannot be decoded. The current iOS platform, if the device is locked, it would take all the computer power in the world, something like two-thirds of the life of the expected life of the universe, to figure out the key that you need to decrypt it. Now, things move fast. We're on the near the age of quantum computing, which was a crackpot theory in 92. And is a reality today. And we're literally building quantum chips. I think, I don't know, was it Intel that just pushed out a 49-qubit chip? So we're very near the place where there may not be unbreakable codes using traditional mathematics.
No more secrets, Marty.
But then we get to use non-traditional mathematics. So the encryption is always, the codes are always going to be ahead of the code breakers. And that's basically what she was saying. And she was right.
Splitting information from all the fields.
This isn't just about large number theory. It's about cryptography.
Huh? You mean codes?
I mean unbreakable codes.
Yeah, and again, some spoilers here. I guess we should have done a spoiler alert, but it's a 26-year-old people, okay?
Yeah, it's older than probably a lot of the people listening to it, so listening to the podcast. So yeah, what, go see it.
They go to this lecture, and she speculates that he's actually figured out a way to solve these. They don't mention quantum computing, I don't think, specifically.
No.
But some way he's figured out to solve the math in a faster way that you mentioned, faster than the heat death of the universe, right?
Yep.
And I think this is kind of a nod to RSA.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I did some research, and Len Edelman, I think that's how you say it, he's one of the designers of RSA.
He's the A in RSA, yeah.
He was a consultant for this film. And, the slides in the lecture, he actually created those slides for the movie. So
I did not know that. That is fantastic.
But he creates a little piece of hardware, I guess, with some, I assume, some software embedded into it. And that's the MacGuffin of this movie. It's a magic box that can decrypt anything.
Decrypt anything, right. Which is, decrypt anything, of course, is a... That's fantasy right there.
Sure.
Anyway, because there's many different algorithms and many different ciphers, this general idea that there can be some mathematical weakness. I mean, so the RC4 cipher is famous for this. It literally has a mathematical weakness. It does not appropriate. So encryption is based on these huge prime numbers. That's two-key encryption, public-private key encryption,
right,
is based on these huge prime numbers. And if you can figure out which huge prime numbers were used, this is a huge oversimplification, but you can potentially reverse back to the private key that was used. So if you can find the private key, the public key is obviously public, you can then decrypt the message. There are algorithms out there that have a weakness in the way that they use those huge prime numbers that allows you to reverse back to the original prime number by looking at the encoded message. That's kind of what they were poking fun at. Back then, we were still dealing with ciphers like DES that used smaller numbers because the computers were small,
right?
We're still dealing with 16-bit. I'd have to look at my history. I think maybe we were looking at 32-bit, like we're sort of looking at 128 today. But I'm sure someone will fact check me at some point. They had to go read if you have a minute, go read Matt Curtin's book on breaking the DES at 56 bits and how they went about doing that by just tying together a bunch of individual computers on the early internet, right? And they used a distributed model. Very similar to how like the Bitcoin miners do the sneaky stuff in the JavaScript today in your browser. Something similar to that in order to basically reverse the private key of a 56-bit DES encrypted message to prove to the government that a normal group of people can decrypt something. And they use the mathematical weakness of the algorithm to do that, and that's more or less what they were giving a nod to in this movie 3 years before that happened. DES was still out. I think Matt did that work all the people he worked with, it was just him, in 95, but I could be wrong. It might have been earlier than that. But that's what it felt like to me. It was a nod to that research. The normal cryptographers, the cypherpunks, as it were out looking at these in my opinion anyway, remarkably complex mathematical weaknesses and leveraging them to decrypt these messages.
No one has been able to accomplish such constructions yet.
It's some pretty serious stuff.
Yeah, and you mentioned that it's a little bit unrealistic because you can't break every code, but there is even a nod to that in the movie. The guy from Russia says that your codes are completely different than ours.
Different from ours, right, exactly.
There is, even in that, there's a touch of realism. So
That's true, yeah. I'd forgotten that line, you're right, I remember that now, yeah.
So another theme of this movie, and this is definitely something that have to be changed a lot in a modern remake, a hypothetical modern remake, is privacy and surveillance. Yeah, when they go to research the guy, Werner Brandis, to go to research him, they basically follow him around, see where he drives, see where he lives, and look at his garbage. They look at his all his different habits. I think in today's world, this would be a lot easier, actually. Yeah. You could follow him on social media. You could get all kinds of information from him on the internet.
Yeah, if he uses it. I mean, people who are paranoid still stay away, and it's a lot harder to do that. Current police tactics and three-letter agency tactics still involve following people around, using bugs, and digging through your trash. That's still... I don't do physical pen testing or red teaming, but the people that I know who do, trash bin out back is one of the first places they go. So that's still very much reality. But yeah, definitely, if they remade the movie for today, they'd have to look quite a bit at the realities of, I mean, is there anything he uses? Because even those, like, I'm not a big Facebook user, not because I'm a private person. I'm not, actually. I'm an author. I'm quite public. But I don't particularly care for Facebook. I do use other things, though. And I use Twitter, but that's kind of something I manage a little bit. So there's not a lot to be gleaned there. But for instance, things like, you know, if you use like Yelp and leave reviews, and you can figure out like what restaurants people go to, or you use Untappd for beer, and you can figure out what bars and what nights. I mean, if you watch my Untappd account, you can see that, you know, I don't publish a lot on there, but I have a fairly regular pattern, and you could use that against me if you needed to physically have access to me. And not that anybody should do that, so just forget that I said that. But it's true. We leave all these marks, and even outside social media, there's a lot of talk about the dark web, right, which is generally a term used to refer to Tor hidden services on the Tor network, the private network that hides your location and stuff. You can also hide services on there. Those services can be websites and like, so that's the dark web. We're not going to worry about that today. But the deep web is a term that usually refers to all this just massive terabytes a minute amount of data that is available just for free. I'll give a nod out here to Justin Nordine and he has an open source project that is very cool for the OSINT framework. So OSINT is open source intelligence. And if you go to osintframework.com, you can see he's collected just this massive collection of, I don't know, I think it's up to like 1,500 links of ways you can go look people up. And for instance, not too long ago, on a fluke, I found out that I could take a license plate and get all the way to a person's address just using information that's free and legal and openly available on the internet. So, I mean, imagine if you could, you know, build a little Raspberry Pi device and sit in your car that would scan the license plate of the person in front of you and then tell you where they're going. And you can do that. That deep web data that's really where people are going to go to find the nitty gritty stuff that they need in order to do the kind of work that they did in the movie.
Wow, that's some cool stuff. I'm going to link to all this stuff in crosscuttingconcerns.com. Use it responsibly, folks.
Yeah, absolutely. Please keep in mind, breaking the law is still breaking the law. This stuff's, you know, legal to use, but you know, don't break the law.
Now, they do mention in this movie he used a computer dating service, which is kind of a relic of the time, but these days it would just be Match.com or, you know, OkCupid or something like that.
Mm-hmm,
so exactly. It still exists.
Yeah. Yeah, I was really surprised, actually, just jump in there. I'd forgotten that. And I'm thinking, this is 92. They designed the movie probably in the late 80s. What was it, CompuServe or something? I mean, the public, I mean, Tim didn't even write the web server until, you know, December of 90.
Right.
So we're crossing over pretty quick here. That had to have been some, I don't know. that was pretty amazing.
I think a computer dating service used to mean you'd send in your stuff on paper and a computer would do the matching. Like, it's not like an online service. I think so. Wow. This is a little bit before my time, so I don't know.
Yeah.
And it comes back at the end of the movie. at the climax where he says a computer matched her with him. I don't think so. Right. And that gives him away. So that's kind of funny. So I want to talk about social engineering because that is basically what this movie is about. It's
basically
all social engineering. I mean, there's some hacking, some technology stuff going on, but a lot of, especially the most fun parts of the movie, are all about basically being a professional con man.
So in the security world, there's a you think of InfoSec people, right? And they're this category, and they have their own conferences, and they go to Vegas in the summer and break things and like that. But really, there's a wide diversity. The closer you look at it, the more it divides. It's very strange. So there is. I'm right on topic here. You can broadly define security people as blue team and red team, right? So the blue team people are the defenders. They are the people that are writing the defenses in the software, that are configuring the defenses in the network, that are making sure you have strong glass in your front window, that all those pieces. So they're the blue team. They're the defenders. They're the watchers. They're the people that sit and watch the log files scroll by, that kind of stuff. And then there's the red team. And the red team are the people that test the defenses to make sure they're adequate. And I'm a member of that. So when you look at red team more closely, you get even deeper and deeper. The core cast of the movie, they were a red team. They almost exactly match to a contemporary red team. There is normally a physical specialist, a social engineering specialist, a OPSEC specialist, operations security specialist, an application security specialist, a signals intelligence specialist, and you can map though. I don't do names of characters super well, so I can't directly tell you who everybody is. But the blind guy whose name I've of course forgotten
is Whistler.
Yeah, Whistler. Yeah. Whistler is his codename. That most closely matches to application security. Of course, back then we didn't have websites to crack into. Of course, today we do, and so that most closely matches to me, which. Makes sense because I'm practically blind anyway. Redford's character would be the he's a leader, obviously. Every team needs a leader, but he's also the social engineer. He's the one who goes in and does the talking and pretends like he's someone who isn't in order to get something done. Those people really exist in real life, and I associate with them all the time. And there's companies that are designed to do this. There are some great videos. I'll send you a link, Matt, to one of them you can put on there. Dave Kennedy, who came and spoke at CodeMash a couple years ago, is far more than a social engineer. He's a good developer and a lot of other things. But he has this great video where NBC interviewed him, and he, not live, it was recorded, but in real time, called this reporter's boss and basically, using a combination of a very good-looking website and some previous information he'd gathered, per what I said earlier about doing research, convinced this reporter's boss to give him his credit card number or social security number, so I don't remember what, and then took over an account of his, like, in front of the cameras.
Wow.
And when he came to CodeMash and did his talk, he did a live thing there where he asked somebody for their last name and what city they lived in, and then pulled up his social security number on his laptop and made the guy come up from the crowd and look at his laptop and say, yep, that's my social security number. He didn't distribute it. That's the incredible depth of detail that the contemporary social engineers do. And they have conferences and training classes and podcasts and everything else, and just like we do in the development space. So it is a real thing. And it is highly in demand. If you're looking for a career change and you're good at that, I don't know if anybody wants to admit they're good at that. But if you are, it is a remarkable, remarkable thing. At one of the security conferences, regional conferences. So for those of you who know CodeMash, think of it as like a CodeMash for security. It's called DerbyCon. Coincidentally, Dave Kennedy runs it, same person I mentioned earlier. They have a social engineering capture the flag where they're given a company, and they have to do a bunch of background research. And then live in the room, they're put in a soundproof clear box, and they call the company, call the front desk, and try to get some pertinent piece of information about the company from the people who work there. And the senior execs are warned, but the people that are being talked to have no idea what's going on. And there are videos out there of it. It is some amazing stuff. And this is how the bad guys are getting stuff from us. So this is very real testing that needs to be done. And that's exactly what these guys did. It's funny, Gabriella and I noticed last night that they called them sneaks. When they talked about the jobs they did, like that first bank job they did, they called it a sneak. And now, of course, we call it a pen test. It's short for penetration test. It's interesting that even there's a parallel there that still matches up today. Different term, but the idea still matches.
I mean, that's the most fun scenes in this movie are some of the social engineering where he's taking the cake into the offices.
And exactly.
He just uses stress on a person, you know, multiple people talk to him to sneak by.
Yeah.
It's great stuff. Another theme, I want to combine a couple of themes here just to keep things moving here, but the deepest theme of this movie is at the very beginning, it's a couple of kids at Berkeley, I think, and they're hacking mainframes. They're doing it, well, because it's fun, right? And Martin says it's a way to meet girls, that sort of thing, a way to impress girls. But there's sort of an underlying idealism here about, you know, who should have control and what the most important thing in the world is in this movie. And this is sort of the ending monologue, is that information is now more important than guns, more important than natural resources. You know, it's all just ones and zeros, I think is what he says.
Right.
Don't you know the places we can go with this?
Yeah, I do. There's nobody there.
Exactly. The world isn't run by weapons anymore, or energy, or money. It's run by little ones and zeros, little bits of data. It's all just electrons.
I don't care.
There's a war out there, old friend. A world war. And it's not about who's got the most bullets. It's about who controls the information. What we see and hear, how we work, what we think. It's all about the information.
Yep, exactly that.
And that theme is definitely, I think, become more and more true as the internet grows. And
right, it's far more true today than it was then.
Yeah.
So that was truly future-looking. There was a recent Economist cover, in fact, showing an oil rig with, you know, binary digits flowing out of the top of it. And it's true. Data today is the new oil. The collection of data and being able to combine it in such a way that you can forward-think decisions and guess what's going to happen next is really, that's what makes or breaks businesses these days. Whereas before, making prudent financial decisions and dictating to the consumer what they wanted was the way the company would win. And if you could figure out who did that best, you'd win in the stock market. Today, it's very much the company who can predict where consumers are going. Very different from in the 90s where they were telling us what to buy. Now we're telling them what we want. And they're guessing in advance. And if they guess right, then they win. And there's, you know, lots of stories. I mean, it's a microcosm, but if you look at Kickstarter, I mean, there are things that have been Kickstarter that have become big companies now. And there are things that have Kickstarter that have spectacularly crashed and burned and ridiculed because of it. And that is the same thing. Who has the best data to figure out what's going to happen next? So the question comes in, how are we going to protect that data? Or are we? Can we even get there? Can we even protect it? The only way to prevent organizations from collecting information about what you do on the internet is not to use any of the services. I mean, think about what Amazon knows about you. You know, every movie you watch, every product you buy. I mean, it's insane. And this goes far beyond, you know, knowing your credit card number, social security number. They don't want to take one person, right? And do something. That's for one thing, it's against the law. For another thing, it's not useful. A company like Amazon wants to take the temperature of a social demographic and then decide what they're going to want to do next. When they came out with the Echo, a lot of people were laughing at them. And now they're not quite ubiquitous yet, but boy, they're getting there real fast. They made the right call. That's the kind of appliance that people want in their house for voice interaction. Other companies said, oh, no, mobile phones is where they're... No, the PC is where they're going to want to be. No. No, a nice looking thing you can set in your living room that'll play music and set timers and read your recipes and tell you the news and check the weather and turn on and off your lights and tell you a joke and amaze and astound your friends. That's what people who spend money are looking for. Who knew? Well, Amazon knew because they had all this data, and that's where it came out.
Yeah, I want to talk about voice identification a little bit, and maybe that'll apply to the Echo. But just one more thing. You sort of mentioned that companies are looking at data to understand where people are going to be. There's a quick little exchange between Martin Bishop and Cosmo in his office, right next to his Cray computer. Mm-hmm. And it's about banks. And they say, okay, suppose, I'll put the clip in here instead of my voice, but...
When I was in prison, I learned that everything in this world, including money, operates not on reality, but the perception of reality.
Pause it.
People think a bank might be financially shaky. Consequence.
People start to withdraw their money.
Result, pretty soon it is financially shaky.
Conclusion. You can make banks fail.
I've already done that.
Right? So it's this idea of perception leads to... Perception of reality leads to reality.
And we're looking at that today with Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
So Bitcoin is a money exchange mechanism pretending like it's a fiat currency. People are like, hey, we're going to invest in this. Invest in what? All you're investing in is the fact that people think it's worth money. The problem is, as they point out very accurately 25 years ago, that the same thing could be said for the U.S. dollar or any other currency that isn't backed by something tangible. Now, you know, the U.S. dollar is backed by all the assets of the U.S. government, so there's that. But surely there aren't enough assets in the U.S. government, like physical assets, land and property and ideas and whatnot, to back the amount of dollars that are in the market. And everybody knows that, and yet a dollar is still worth a dollar. You know, I can still go to the dollar store and buy a cheap padlock to practice on for a buck. That same idea is true because it's the market's so unregulated was shown very accurately with the Bitcoin changes recently. It's a huge spike, huge crash. That could happen in banks if you had adequate control of what people thought, which is a big topic. Might be the version 2 of the podcast.
Okay, so you mentioned Echo. Let's talk about voice identification. It's a big plot point in this movie.
Yeah.
That you needed to say a certain phrase in your own voice to get through a locked door. And in 1992, I'm pretty sure this is not feasible. But how feasible is that sort of thing today? And would it be useful? Or could it be as easily broken with tape as they did in the movie?
Yeah. It's easily broken with tape. And that's why we don't use it. The current fascination with face will soon go away. That's relatively, we had somebody, the iPhone X, right, with its face recognition. And of course, even Windows Hello, not to poke fun at Microsoft, because I think they do great work. But the first, somebody built a complex 3D printed mask, and then somebody basically crafted a mask like you would do an early sculpture model. And then somebody taped a photo of someone to their face, and it still worked. Biometrics is something that is, man, wouldn't it be awesome if that's just the way it was, that we just, the computer knew who we were and just did things.
Yeah.
And in a way you can do that, but we always use it as like high security. Oh, it's not just a password, they want your thumbprint too. Well, I mean, a thumbprint is your username, but it's not really a password. You know, a password is something only you know, and you can modify at will. I don't know about you, but the thought of modifying my thumbprints does not appeal. The same thing is true of a face. The same thing is true of voice. Your voice is more fallible than all the others. I mean, if you lose your voice or have an injury, then, you know, you have a problem accessing your information. And once again, it's far easier to, you know, piece together somebody's voice in a recording than it is even to steal their thumbprints, which is still 100% possible. One of the problems that we have with the iPhones is that in current U.S., well, most states' law, an officer can legally compel you to thumbprint, authenticate into an iPhone, but they can't legally compel you to tell you their password.
I see.
That seems like a authoritarian thing, but it's not. It just reflects how really weak biometrics is as a password. As a username is great. Putting my thumbprint on something to say, hey, I'm Bill. And then, okay, Bill, tell me something only you know. Or somehow prove to me you're actually Bill. That's the thing. The thumbprint doesn't prove it. It just says who I am. And the same thing should be true of the voice. They did accurately use two-factor, though. If I remember correctly, they had a number pad and you had to put in a PIN.
It was a card.
Or a card, yeah. Or something. Yeah. Yeah, card. So it was something you have and something you are.
Hi, my name is Werner Brandis. My voice is my passport. Verify me.
And that's, I mean, it's two-factor. It's, I mean, they were giving a solid nod to security on that. That's what you want to try to do for high security environments. But those are two of the weakest, because you can always steal something somebody has, and it's pretty easy to replicate something that somebody is.
So two things. One, I've been using a fingerprint scanner on my phone for probably a year now. And you're telling me that maybe this is not as secure as I think.
So here's the deal. Everybody has to make a decision between security and convenience. Uh-huh. That's the gray area we play all the time, even in application security. Sometimes it's really inconvenient to force the user to change their password every month. And even NIST bowed to that by saying that making users change their password is forcing people to use system-based passwords. So the name of the company plus the name of the month or whatever is their password. So don't do that anymore. Don't make people change them as often. That's the same deal with the convenience factor of the thumbprint. I mean, yeah, okay, it's true. If somebody snuck in the office right now, hit me on the head, and I fell over, first, I kind of hope you would call 911 if that happened. But second, they could indeed take my phone out of my pocket, put my thumb on it, and it would open for them. And then they could access everything my phone can do, which is a not insignificant amount of things. Yeah. The likelihood of that for me is pretty small. Now, if I worked for a three-letter agency, or even if I was like a red team, like a real on-site pen tester, I would be more concerned about those kinds of things. But with what I do and how I live my life, the convenience is worth it. So I also use my thumbprint scanner on my phone. And other people who are in low-risk environments, I tell them the same thing. It's all about your personal risk model. Now, obviously, these six folks in the sneak team, they're living a high-risk life. They need to, if they were in today, they'd have to look at things a little differently.
And the other thing I want to ask about, not in this movie, but a lot of Hollywood movies, you see a retina scan as a security factor. Yeah. Would you call that similar to a fingerprint?
Yeah, it's exactly the same. The algorithms that do it don't actually use the thumbprint. They use like distances between certain things, so you can even brute force them by guessing. It's really, really fascinating. We're talking about how encryption was a little bit out of my realm. That's really far out of my realm. But I've seen some really compelling videos using both retinal scans and thumbprints. One of the coolest ones I've seen biometrically recently is gait analysis. So as you're, like, so for instance, walking through a store, say an Amazon, makes physical stores, Google or whoever, and they touch your phone to say, hey, what's this person's gait look like normally? And there's a batch of data that comes back because the phone's in your pocket, right? or it's always in the same place. It's on your belt, in your pocket, wherever it happens to be. Or say if you have a smartwatch, like an Apple Watch or whatever, it gets data from there and says, well, this is the pattern of this person's gait in all these different arrangements. And then the store, with its sensors, can tell who you are based on how you move around the store. And before you go, wow, that's kind of far-fetched, it works. They have working models of this that are like reliable, not just it worked once for a demo. It's they have stores that do this exact thing. And you have to install the app on your phone first, and you have to opt in. It's not something they can do sneaky. But I'm pretty sure it's an Amazon store in Seattle that you can literally walk the store, pick stuff up, and walk out, and it'll just bill your Amazon account. It's amazing. So they're headed places.
So one other thing from that scene I thought I'd bring up, and this is just a small moment, but I kind of thought about this because I was preparing for the podcast. The bad guy, Cosmo, he walks right through that gate with a remote control.
Right. So let's talk about backdoors, right? And that's a big topic. So to do full circle, you go all the way back to encryption. So the current federal government would like companies to put encryption in place that has a known backdoor, so we talked about the mathematical flaws, a known mathematical flaw, but of course we're going to keep that a secret. Only the government's going to know it. So that if a bad guy, you know, does something bad and drops his phone or dies or whatever, and then we can get his phone, we can unlock his phone because we know the key, right? We know the backdoor. And of course, you know, we won't ever let the bad guys have the key, because we're going to keep things secure, just like we do with all of our data, which we don't, but that's okay. So that's exactly what that was. And they didn't, I'm imagining that that was left, because you know they film a lot of different, they film a lot of film and only use a portion of it for the movie, right? You're a movie person. The movie could have been 8 hours long, but they they cut it down to two because nobody will sit for 8 hours and watch a movie. I'm imagining that that back door probably was a plot device that they were thinking about maybe using if they needed it. But that scene was so good because everybody just performed so well. They left that scene with him with the remote control in the movie, even though they never really used it. And I don't know that for a fact. I have no background information. Just when I watched it, I went, huh, I bet they were planning on doing something with that. And they just didn't. But that scene was so solid. They used it as how he got in. Because with the energy of the film at that moment, it would have been really silly for him to go and do the voice thing. It would have slowed down everything. Yeah. That points directly to the current take on especially mobile devices. And, hey, we want these encryption, fine. Keep the bad guys out of your stuff. But we want to be able to decrypt it. Oh, great. Okay, so who's we and how exactly are you going to protect this data? And the answer is, of course, they won't. Because if some human can figure out a way to weaken the encryption, some other human can figure out the same way. And so someone will eventually break it. And then we'll be back to square one, where if somebody wants your data, they can just get it. That's definitely a theme on the encryption side that was kind of pointed to with the physical security thing in the movie.
So I would be remiss if I didn't bring up this, one of my favorite scenes with you specifically. Mm-hmm. There is, he's breaking into the professor's office, and there's a number padlock on the door. And this scene is hilarious. I love this scene.
He starts to get out his lockpicks and looks down and goes, oh, man.
So that's something I didn't notice until this time watching the movie. He actually has a lockpick in hand.
Yeah, which is funny. Do you know what you call one thing that can open a lock?
What's that?
A key. You need two tools to pick a lock open. Right. Now, you could argue that he just hadn't gotten the tensioner out of his bag yet. But and I choose to believe that he just had, because Gabrielle pointed that out immediately when we were watching the movie together, that he had just gotten a pick out and nothing else. He saw the number lock. But that's very interesting because very important room, right? Stuff inside of it's very important. Mm-hmm. Electronic lock on the outside, because if you're going to push buttons, it's got to be like very unlikely that's mechanical.
Yeah.
How do you get in that room if the power goes out?
I haven't even thought of that.
So if you go to Lowe's and look at the keypad locks, which Schlage makes a great one. I highly recommend it. You will notice that it still has a deadbolt in it.
Mm-hmm.
So if the power goes out or the battery dies, you can still get in your house. There isn't, to my knowledge, a keypad lock that doesn't also have a physical bypass. Because, because what if the power goes out? You know, you literally can't get in. Right. But then, of course, he finds a different physical bypass.
Anybody remember how to defeat an electronic keypad?
Oh. Don't even joke about that, Martin. Those things are impossible.
Think I'm joking? Looks like they just put it in.
Oh, boy.
Here, maybe this might help. An old buddy of mine who was in Desert Storm sent it to me. Of course, he was on the other side.
Come on, Kreese. There's got to be a way around these things.
All right. This might work.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. I'll give it a shot. That worked.
So that's the funny part, because it reminded me of, there's an XKCD comic. And it's about, I'll link to it in the show notes, but it's about sort of a crypto nerd's fantasy. Is that I've got my system so locked down with 4,096-bit encryption that bad guys are trying to break in. They're like, it's impossible. We can't get in. But what actually happens is they drug him and beat him with a $5 wrench until he gives them the password. So this is exactly what's happening in this scene.
Exactly. And so it's funny because on my notes that I left for myself, I have rule one. Brute force works. If you have physical access to a system, you own it. If you're standing in front of a door, you probably can kick it in. And then how that matters in application security is we can write scripts to try every combination. So if you have something, some directory hidden on your web server that has stuff in it you don't want people to see, and you've named it something really obscure, keep in mind, I have all the time in the world as an attacker to write a script that's just going to test everything in order to find that directory. So the best solution is simply not to hide things. Now, of course, for a door, that's kind of difficult. But always keep in mind that the attacker doesn't really have that much interest in the finer points of breaking into something, that they're always willing to go to brute force. That's always the solution. So you can have the fanciest lock on your front door you want, but if you've got a 2.5-inch deadbolt and 3-inch screws holding your door in place, or a wood door rather than a steel, they're just going to kick it in. That's a fact in the movie, and it's a fact in real life as well.
All right, so I want to talk about maybe some problems we have with the movie, but first, let's just some more trivia that I researched, and I feel like I need to actually get some use out of this. So this movie was produced by a pair of guys, Lasker and Parks, and you mentioned this earlier. They are the same team that produced War Games, and they conceived this movie while doing research for War Games. And so War Games may be next on my list for an episode, because it's also a pretty good movie in terms of technology and realism and some of these same...
It doesn't hold up quite as well because it's... I mean, for one thing, it's, what, 6 years older, 7 years older.
Yeah.
Also, the visibility into the network, they forward thought a little teeny bit in Sneakers and War Games. That's literally... I mean, I was doing exactly what he was doing in War Games. Mm-hmm. I was doing it. So the network wasn't nearly what it was. So it's a little bit more of a historical film, but still a great film. Absolutely. And we should definitely talk about that.
The movie's set in San Francisco, which absolutely makes sense for a tech-heavy film like this.
Yep.
There's lots of references to, I think they're references to Captain Crunch in this movie.
So you mentioned that a lot, and you know, I hadn't noticed any of that. But I go back and I'm like, wow. You know, it's really funny because you mentioned, we were talking earlier about Whistler.
Fellas, Janet's little black box is on his desk between the pencil jar and the lamp.
Whistler, I hate to tell you this, but you're blind.
Play the tape back again.
You can't even see anything.
Don't look. Listen.
Play it back.
And of course, that's where Captain Crunch's fame came from, because he figured out the tone to whistle to break through the AT&T long-distance lines arrival code.
There I was in prison. And
one day I help a couple of nice older gentlemen make some free telephone calls.
2600 hertz. 2600 millihertz. Well, 2600 somethings. that's another thing that I'm weak on, like most things. And I hadn't seen the box of Captain Crunch. I hadn't seen the Scrabble board. I hadn't seen any of the things you mentioned. It's like, I don't know. It really, now that second look, it's like, oh yeah, okay. They definitely gave a nod to that. And they obviously did a bunch of freaking. I mean, the opening scene, he's down there messing with the phone wires and they're, you know, sending taps into the phone system to, it was a very phone freak kind of vibe to the beginning of the movie. They dropped it later a little bit, until they started to work the breadboard to get the encryption box working. But that wasn't phone related, but it's the same kind of signals intelligence that you do with phones. So yeah, I think that you're probably right on top of that.
Most of the stuff I'm pulling from IMDb trivia, so don't think of me as some genius spotting all these things.
That's very interesting. I should have taken a look at that. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
Bernard Abbott is played by James Earl Jones in this film from the NSA. Mm-hmm. He is named after Robert Abbott, who was also a tech consultant on this movie, and I've not heard of the system before, but he's one of the designers of the CDC 6600, which was the first multi-user operating system.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about that. That didn't click at all to me. Like I said, the trivia section in IMDb is something else. There's no question.
He's sometimes known as the father of information security. So the movie has pretty good pedigree when it comes to tech consultants.
Yes. In this. Yes, and you mentioned War Games, and I'd point out that just as a look forward to the next one, that movie does as well.
Yeah.
Has a lot of good credit. So a lot of these hacker movies, they do get people in. I mean, the contemporary example would be Mr. Robot. Yeah. If you haven't seen that, it's a little gritty for me personally, but it's especially if you like gritty stuff, it's a great well-written and series, and the tech consultants on it are contemporary InfoSec specialists, people I know personally and had beers with. So that's definitely the way to go with stuff like this. And it did unquestionably leave a mark on this movie.
Yeah, the more I research Mr. Robot details, the more surprised I am to find how realistic that show is. Mm-hmm. And speaking of TV series, there is a Sneakers TV series that's been rumored to be in development for a year or two. I think it'd be a great series, and maybe like a less gritty, more fun Mr. Robot. So I'm looking forward to that if it happens.
Yeah, definitely if it has the same kind of con man vibe, yeah, rather than the very, you know, I don't even know what word to use vibe that Mr. Robot has, that would be fantastic. And if you're interested in a reality TV series that does this, there was a short run of some episodes with Chris Nickerson, who's an extraordinarily well-known red teamer out of Denver, Colorado. His company's name is Lares. I believe the series is called Tiger Team. I think they only did a run of maybe 6 or 8 episodes, and then it just, I don't know, it didn't, whatever reason, they didn't continue it. They, you know, the studios do it for a lot of different reasons. But a couple of the episodes are kind of funny. They're not family friendly, okay. So keep that in mind if you choose to watch them.
maybe a chance to talk about a few problems that you had with the movie. This is mostly nitpicking, I think, because we understand it's a film, and some concessions have to be made to make it more entertaining or to shorten for time. So you mentioned the decryption already. When they show the decryption in action, it doesn't work like that at all. It was very visual. Like, the spacing was there. It was just the characters that were... It was like a substitute cipher sort of thing, right?
Right. As it turns out, decryption is really boring. Yeah. I mean, if you're trying to brute force decrypt something, you're getting it one character at a time. And if you have the private key, it just shows up. There's no magic. Yeah. So that was their one nod to the magic that you see in, you know, movies like... I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but I'm sure there's a bunch of them out there that have the super graphic interfaces that do all kinds of stuff. Right. And you're like, it doesn't work that way at all. Yeah. That was their one nod to that. So I'll give them that one.
There was the obligatory enhance the photo scene. They didn't really say enhance, but they showed very big lenses that they were using. So it's possible, but there was that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well. Especially that their video, I wrote that off because their video devices were so good. They were in their input devices and their monitors were so bad.
Yeah.
That's almost, it's a lot better than when they do it on NCIS, right, and have the huge wall-sized screens and like that. So I might give them that one as well.
Let me ask you this. This is something that's bothered me every time I watch the film. The Cosmo, the bad guy, he's played by Ben Kingsley. What is the deal with his accent in this movie?
I don't know. I have no idea what they're trying to do there. I think they're just trying to make him foreign and scary. And that's, it seemed a little silly to me because... I think there was enough scary in this movie if you're already looking forward to the realities of where things are going informationally. It's hard to think back in 92, something like 7% of the U.S. population had an email address, you know? now there's, most people have 2, if not 3. And so it's difficult to put your mindset back then, but there are a fair number of people who are looking forward and going, wait, this is all freaky stuff. Everything's connected. And now, of course, things really are all connected. And I don't know why they felt they needed to do that. But whatever. He handled it okay, so.
Yeah, I don't think he's foreign, though. I know the actor is, but it was just a weird sort of... I don't know if he made the decision to do the voice or what, but...
I don't know. It was very weird.
Another thing, this is kind of a blink and you'll miss it sort of thing, but when they're in the surveillance truck and the security guards capture them, one of the security guards calls the Sidney Poitier character, he calls him Midnight, which I thought was kind of unnecessary.
Well, so very noticeably, and this would be pointed out if the movie were made today, is I think Sidney was the only non-white person in the film of any significance.
Except for
anyway.
James Earl Jones, right?
Well, except for James Earl Jones, that's right, yeah, of course. And remember, in the next scene, what does he say? You asked why I was fired from
the CIA.
My temper. They were making that made him mad.
Right.
So that was their egging him on, you know, making him mad. So that's they made him mad. And in today's environment, you don't say things like that and whatever. But it's a movie, and people do in reality say things like that all the time. So and you put that stuff in your fiction, and that would make him mad. I understand. And then he got them out of the situation because he was mad. So it furthered the plot.
Right. And I'm sure that point in Sidney Poitier's career, he could absolutely, would not have happened unless he was okay with it. So
I'm sort of hoping
anyway. But it just seemed kind of gratuitous. So
yeah.
The other thing that bothers me, and this is not just this film, but lots of Hollywood movies, when you're crawling around in ceilings.
Yeah.
They look like suspended ceilings. I mean, absolutely yeah. not hold
There's
your
just
weight.
Little. If you've never looked up in one, do that though. Don't do it in like your office because probably somebody will flip out. But poke up that those suspensions are just held up with these little wires.
Yeah.
There's no way you could crawl around in there. It's nuts. They do that in like every movie
yeah,
too.
I know.
I don't.
And they also have ventilation systems that are big enough to crawl through as well.
I know. Well, and there are some ventilation. Some parts of the ventilation system that are big,
sure.
but not the ones that go into individual rooms. Yeah. That's kind of weird.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to mention about Sneakers? Would you recommend watching it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you should totally take a look. I recommend a hacker movie night, you know?
That does sound fun.
Line up this and some of the sillier ones and War Games and some others. Maybe the first Matrix to end things because it's science fictiony. Yeah. But it's certainly worth a watch. It's extremely well acted. It's easy. It's an easy watch. There's not a lot of, you don't have to do a lot of wait, hang on analysis with it. They feed you pretty well. I'm an easy movie watcher, so I'm a big fan of that. I definitely recommend it.
Is there anything you'd like to plug or promote before we wrap up?
Not right this minute. Most of the stuff I have is local, so the local listeners, you know, come out to the local OWASP meeting, or you know what? Heck with that. OWASP is an international organization. You're listening. You're a dev. Stop by your local OWASP meeting. You can probably find them on Meetup. Most of us are. It's the Open Web Application Security Project. It's just another meetup group. You'll find that probably 2/3 of the people there are security people, but we all need more devs in. The whole idea of the group is to distribute security knowledge to developers, and that's what we do at our individual chapter meetings. Go try one. See if you like the vibes, see if you like the people. Worst case scenario, you're going to learn something.
My guest today has been Elf Blimps, a.k.a. Bill Semph. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, sir.
Cross-cutting concerns.
This has been the Cross-Cutting Concerns podcast, produced and recorded by Matt Groves, 2018. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it on social media and leave a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you downloaded this podcast. For show notes, please go to crosscuttingconcerns.com. This episode is recorded under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. Hosting for this episode was made possible in part by Microsoft.
This week's podcast was brought to you by Smartsheet. Are your projects pulled off like Band-Aids? You need Smartsheet. No more pain. Just simple, collaborative work management in the cloud from a beautiful UI.
It was recorded and mixed with the help of Camtasia Recorder, Skype, and Audacity. Music is by Joe Ferg. Check out joeferg.com, JOEFERG, to listen to more great music.
Stay on your toes, step up your code, stay on your toes, step up your code, stay on your toes. Cross-cutting concern with Matt Groves.